Morning, everyone, and welcome to the start of what we consider our summertime. And so if you're visiting us as someone from down south or from other parts of the world, we want to really welcome you. And as part of this morning's service, I've been asked to conduct a short census. The Christian Research Organization is doing another Scottish Church census. I think they do them every decade or so. And we've been asked to participate in them. And so we're providing them data, but they also would like to know something about the makeup of the congregations other than just the people that are there. And so there's a wee sheet here. It will take you a minute and a half. You can do it even when I'm speaking. And as it gets boring, and just fill them in, because we really want to know, what is the state of the church in Scotland? And that question is a sort of key question, isn't it? What is the state of the church in Scotland? What does the church have to say to our world around us? How is the church going to interact? And in the reading, in the Old Testament reading, we had a wonderful phrase about as these people from outside, these Syrians from outside of the people of God came to seek after God. They were self-interested. They wanted God to do something for them. But the key phrase was that they might know there is a prophet in Israel. What was it that was going to show that there was a prophet in Israel? That God was at work amongst his people? What was going to affirm that? What was going to make the communities outside of the community of faith recognize that and see that? That's a big question. That's a big question for us today. How are they going to know that there is a prophet in and amongst God's people? How will those outside of the community of faith believe this? As part of the summer, what I usually do, or I used to do, I didn't do it last year, I don't think, is that we have a thing called the tourist season. And I've explained often the rationale of the tourist season, which is during the summer when most people are away, we don't want to preach our best sermons. And nevertheless, and I don't mean it that way. I just mean that things that we want to say to the whole of the church, we have to refer to later on when everybody's here. But the same thing, we also don't want to tread water. We want to actually do something that's meaningful and engaging. And one of the ways that I've solved this dilemma over the years is by actually doing a sort of retrospective in terms of the Scottish church, in terms of the history of Christianity in Scotland. And it's great for the tourists because they learn a little bit about Scotland. And it's good for the church because we learn about examples and things. And it's a difficult thing to do because it's combining history and the Bible and looking at the example of the church. But a lot of people enjoy it. I know some people don't enjoy it so much. But it is a good thing for us to do, to learn from the past. To learn from the past, particularly as we look at the question of how did Scotland become Christian? How did God work in the past in terms of our history? I actually think that patterns are really important in terms of history and the work of God in a nation. I sometimes, if you go and find a church that's failing, and you go and speak to them, and you say, how did you get started? And they say something like, we started as a children's club, or we started through Sunday school. And that's how we attracted people, and that's how this church grew. And then you say to them, you know something? Maybe that's what you have to go and do again. And if you do children's work, it might be the key to the renewal of your church. And invariably it is. So often the past holds keys for the present and our future. And I hope through series like this, we can do this, because these aren't historical exercises. These are actually about asking that question, how will the people of Scotland know that there is a prophet in Israel? How will they know that God is alive and work in our nation in the midst of the political turmoil that is going on? So for the next few weeks, we're going to look back at the past. And you'll know I've been doing this for a long time, so it's always hard to find something new or different to do. And actually, I've started to repeat things, but none of you'll notice. And so I've entitled the next few weeks, An Alternative Scottish Church History. The reason we're calling it an alternative Scottish church history is because you probably won't read my version of Scottish church history anywhere else, which maybe should make you suspect. But I know we have a series of professional historians in the church, so just to clarify, in history, you basically have lots of evidence, and the fun of being a historian is that you get to interpret this evidence. And you can interpret evidence in different ways. Some people think it looks like this. Other people think it looks like this. So this is my interpretation of the evidence, okay? And I'm happy to have a coffee with you and discuss why I interpret the evidence this way. But what I want to do is look at how Christianity was right at the founding of our nation of Scotland. Most of you will know from your school history. Well, actually, maybe you won't. I don't know if they teach Scottish church history, or history. They don't teach Scottish history, do they? Maybe that will change. And in the 9th century, Scotland was born through a coming together of a series of different factions and different ethnic and cultural identities. And we were forged into a single national identity, roughly in the 9th century. It was a bloody time, an interesting time. But prior to that, there was a whole fragmentation going on. And there were all sorts of vying forces. There were a group called the Picts, and we're going to be focusing on them for the next few weeks. But the Picts were really the peoples who lived north of the Forth. So anything north from Stirling up to the Shetlands, you can designate the Picts. Except on the west coast of Scotland, sort of Oban in that direction, there was another group, and Mull of Kintyre, there was another group that were called the Scots, but they were really Irish, so that confuses us. But there were the Scots and there were the Picts. And then there were another group, but they were definitely disappearing by this time, and they were called the Britons. You'd be glad to know that the Britons were the Welsh, and they actually all emigrated to Wales, so we can claim what's happening in the European Championships at the moment as our own. If you're from central Scotland, you'll be glad to know. And the Britons ended up mainly in Wales and other bits, France and Cornwall. But there were still a few of them left up here. And then most importantly of all, there were the Anglo-Saxons or the English, who by that time were pressing right in. They had taken most of central Scotland, certainly on the east coast, and they were pressing right into the north of Scotland. And at the end of the 8th century, there was a great big battle near Forfar, and the English were fighting the Picts. This was a critical battle because if the Anglo-Saxons won this battle, then Scotland would never have existed. Some may have thought that was a good idea, but this was a critical moment. And what happened was the Picts won the battle, and it basically secured the future of northern Scotland, that they were not going to be controlled by the Anglo-Saxons, or certainly not controlled easily by the Anglo-Saxons. And it pushed back the Anglo-Saxons. And this was a fascinating period in the history of our nation because it went on to actually provide the building block for what became Scotland as the Scots and the Picts unified against the English, the Anglo-Saxons. And then subsequently, the Scots and the Picts managed to push the Anglo-Saxons back towards Hadrian's Wall, where some of them think they should stay. But anyway, this was the sort of dynamic that was happening at this time. Now, the question is, what was happening in terms of the church and Christianity? You see, there were all kinds of forces at work within Scotland at this time, and all kinds of variants of Christianity. In the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, they hadn't been Christian, and they had been converted through a special emissary from the Pope, who had sent a man called Augustine, who founded a mission in Canterbury, and he had converted most of the Anglo-Saxons by the beginning of the 8th century. And so, largely, England was full of good Roman Catholics, very much connected to Rome, and European Catholicism. The Scots, that's the Irish, they had another version, still originally had been connected to Roman Catholicism, but it kind of got disconnected because of distance. And we call that Celtic spirituality. This had fallen out of favor in England. There had been a big congress in Whitby, There was a problem with a king down there. A king had married an Anglo-Saxon princess, the Northumbrian king. He was having a problem with his wife. This is actually really true. Because they both calculated Easter differently. So the Celtic church and the Anglo-Saxon church had different dates for Easter. That's because the Anglo-Saxon church had taken the modern calendar that Rome had introduced 50 years or so before. And so there was this debate going on. But the problem was, and it was a practical problem for the king, because during the period of Lent, which is the 40 days before Easter, he couldn't have sex with his wife. And as his wife had a different calendar from him, this was creating a rather long period, and this needed to get resolved. And it's not the first time that they needed to get a church council to sort these sort of things out. Anyway, what happened was basically the Anglo-Saxon Roman Catholic calendar won out against the Celtic church, and so the Celtic church fell out of fashion. For the Picts living north of the Forth of Firth, this wasn't a big deal because they really hadn't embraced Christianity. They had interacted with the Celtic church. They had even been educated sometimes by the Celtic church, but they had not become Christians. And although the people of southern Scotland, so the people living south of us, had become Christians hundreds of years before, the Picts had not, and they had resisted, and they had proved very resistant to Christianity for hundreds and hundreds of years. And nobody had managed to crack it. There had been little successes here and there, but they had always gone back. And Patrick, in a very famous letter, talks about the backslidden Picts. And they had stayed either backslidden or pagan for the duration of several hundred years. But everybody else around them was Christian. When the Picts had managed to win this battle against the English, and they knew that their future was secured, for some reason, at this point, they decided to become Christian. Maybe they just recognized it was in their best interest to join this Commonwealth. The question was, what kind of Christianity were they going to opt for? There were two types on offer. There was a Roman Catholic English form, or there was a Celtic form, an Irish form. And they could choose either of those forms. The problem was that the Celtic form was now out of favor. It had just been shown to be displaced by the Anglo-Saxon form, and it wasn't particularly the happening thing. It was maybe seen as yesterday's kind of Christianity. The Anglo-Saxon form, however, was there and seemed like the right kind of Christianity. The problem, though, that the Picts had was it was English. So what were they going to do? Were they going to embrace the Christianity that was present amongst their enemies? Maybe they thought about it. And certainly there was a historian, the only historian that we have who wrote reliable history of this period, who says that that was the way that the Picts were going to go. What he says is that the Picts decided that they were going to kick out all the Celtic missionaries and all Celtic Christianity from Scotland, from northern Scotland, and they were going to embrace good old Roman Catholicism from the Anglo-Saxons. However, and this is where alternative church history starts, I want to suggest that at this moment in time, at this critical moment as Scotland was about to form, at this critical moment in terms of all the socio-political things that were happening, this critical moment in terms of the question of what kind of Christianity is Scotland or the Picts going to embrace, I want to suggest to you at this moment there was a curveball thrown into Scottish history. And that actually an outside form of Christianity that was neither Anglo-Saxon nor Celtic arrived on the shores of Scotland. And as my first piece of evidence, I want to play to you some of the Gaelic psalms from the Isle of Lewis. You'll know my wife comes from the Isle of Lewis. I love going there. I'm going there in a couple of weeks. I really look forward to it. And one of the great joys I have when I go there is I will sneak into sometimes the free churches where they will still sing unaccompanied Gaelic psalms, and I will sit through the services, and I love it. And you might, after listening to this, wonder why, but I love it. Have we got it able to play it?
Yeah.
Psalms. Can't get anything more Scottish, probably couldn't get anything more Celtic. There's a problem, though, in terms of some of our understandings of maybe where these things come from. And I'll tell you where this problem started for me. It actually started when my wife and I were touring Syria. And we went into the great mosque in Damascus. And the great mosque in Damascus used to be a Roman temple. It then became a church. It then became a mosque. Much of Christianity, Byzantine Christianity, was left behind and was reflected in terms of what was happening amongst the Muslims within the mosque. All the shrines there were to Christian saints like John the Baptist and various other individuals who were being acknowledged and homaged in terms of the assembly. The way that they were praying, they all prayed with their hands raised. And if you've ever seen Byzantine Christians praying, it was exactly the same way. But more interestingly, for the purposes of this talk, the singing that went on sounded like the singing of the Western Isles. Oh, it was weirdly Eastern, or maybe the Western Isles singing is weirdly Eastern. In fact, it was so similar, if you closed your eyes and ignored that you were in Damascus, you could have been on the Western Isles listening to the Psalms. Now, I was told by a Greek Orthodox priest when I was living down in London, that the scales and the harmonics that are used in the worship of the Orthodox Church, which was also being repeated in the mosque, which they got from the Byzantine Church, is very distinctive and unique. And he showed me various scales and things. I don't know it musically, but it's exactly the same patterns that are going on in terms of the singing of the Western Isles, as was happening in Syria, in both Muslim and Christian context there. I thought, that's fascinating. Isn't that interesting? And it raised a very interesting question, which is, was there a link? And what I want to suggest to you is that at this critical point, as the nation of Scotland was about to be formed, that actually there came an influence from the east. That actually people traveled from the eastern Mediterranean to Scotland and established a Christian witness amongst the Picts. And the Picts didn't go Celtic, and they didn't go Anglo-Saxon, they went Byzantine. They actually looked to the east. Now, within 150 years, the Anglo-Saxon and the Celtic and the Byzantine had all merged together in a wonderful mixture of cultural coming together. But at this critical point, there was this moment. And I want to tell you a little bit about how this came about. Can we run some of the slides? It came about through a man called Saint Serf, or Servanus. Servanus, or Serf, was the person who converted most of the lowland Picts and possibly had the impact of setting in place the whole conversion of northern Scotland. You will never see a picture of St. Serf, you will rarely see him mentioned. You'll know all about Columba, you'll know about Ninian, but you will not know about St. Serf. And that's because something happened to him in the 12th century that we'll talk about in a few weeks' time. If you like conspiracy theories, come along and listen to it. But he was erased from Scottish church history and became a minor character. But if you live in Alva or Tillicoutry or Dunning, you or Loch Leven, you will have heard of St. Serf because he's the person who brought Christianity to those places. And he's attributed as the apostle that came. The story of St. Serf, his life, is a very unreliable document for historians. And it's full of all sorts of ideas, which actually reflect the different competing claims of Anglo-Saxon Christianity, Celtic Christianity, and other forms of Christianity, because as each group had preeminence in our history, they rewrote the history to reflect their own background to give them. And St. Serf's life reflects this interaction that was going on. But very interestingly, his life starts by telling us that he came from Syria. Now, some people think, oh, this is just nonsense. They've made up some exotic Oriental beginning for St. Seraph. Now, that's possible, and it's one way of interpreting what happened with St. Seraph. The only problem I have with that is no other Scottish saint has these Oriental origins. Nobody else. So it isn't a pattern. It isn't something that's happening in the lives. They always give them these wonderful Oriental origins. St. Seraph is said to have come from Syria. Now, I just want to take that source and that suggestion and say, let's say that's true. Let's say that's true. St. Seraph was from Syria. What was happening? What was going on? Well, this is my hypothesis in terms of St. Seraph. We know that at that point, the places like Syria, and one other source suggests he came from Egypt, but certainly Eastern Mediterranean, is that Islam was running riot and was basically taking over the whole of the Eastern Mediterranean. Seraph, and it wasn't just Seraph, he was a whole community, apparently, maybe got on a ship, and they were leaving a land that was being overrun with Islam. And they were going off in search of maybe sanctuary, but maybe also somewhere else to carry the message of God. And maybe Seraph had a word from God or a sense from God to take the message of Christianity to the ends of the earth. We don't know entirely his whole journey, whether he traveled up through Gaul or whether he sailed. I think he may have sailed. But what the story tells us is that Seraph ends up coming up the Firth of Forth with a whole bunch of companions. Nowadays, we would call them Syrian refugees. And they came sailing up the Firth of Forth. And they came and they turned to the Picts. Now, I don't know why they chose the Picts other than the Anglo-Saxons, but they chose the Picts. They weren't Christians, but they chose the Picts. And they approached the Pictish king who ruled the area around this part of Scotland. And they said, would you give us some land on which we can settle, on which we can live? And the king apparently granted them some land. Maybe I should call him a chieftain. There were 7 of these Pictish kings at least. A chieftain who controlled the region. And he handed them the place that has come to be known as Cool Ross. And Cool Ross was where Seraph and his companions came to live. See, the... can we go to the next picture? They had come out of somewhere in that region, according to the traditions, and they had come to Cool Ross. Let's go to the next slide. Now, these guys were very distinctive. They had a distinctive Christianity. It was not the Christianity of the Celtic Church. Right? Now, and the big thing that made them distinctive was that the priests all married. So they were coming with complete families. Celtic Christians, and if you were a Celtic monk, you didn't marry. Celtic Christianity was very much withdrawing. You would find a wee cell on an island somewhere, and you would just sit there and meditate and think about the other world. And Celtic Christianity was very withdrawn in many of its expressions. It was very otherworldly. And every so often, if you needed some miraculous thing happen, you would go and search out this individual. You usually have to travel to far off distant places, find them, and then bring them back into your world for a short time so that they could carry out a miracle things, and then they'd rush off back to their wee cells. These guys were not like this. They came and they arrived very like Orthodox monks, actually. They were community-based. They were living with children, with wives. And they were living out their faith, not apart. So they weren't building beehive cells off in Scottish islands somewhere to go and meditate. They were actually living as communities. As I say, Cool Ross was founded as a village, as a town, through these Syrian refugees arriving on our shores. But they did something else as well. These guys wanted to live out their faith, and Seraph and his companions had evangelistic hearts. Whether they were searching to run away from what was happening in Eastern Mediterranean, or whether they were on a mission from God who were going to the ends of the earth to bring the word of God, they actually began to represent Christ. And they were known, and they came to be known and called the Chaldees. This phrase, again, is much debated in terms of church history, but the first references to it and the first associations with it are to St. Seraph and his companions from Cool Ross. In fact, Kirkcaldy, you know, Kirkcaldy, that's the church of the Chaldees. That's where the word comes from. And actually, the whole of the Fife's coast and the East Coast has lots and lots of churches and places that they established. We'll talk more about that next week. But they were known, and the word Chaldees means servants or worshippers of God. Saint Serf or Servanus means servant. They were known as servants. Now, here's the thing. Who knew them as the servants of God? Who was it? It wasn't, they weren't calling themselves that. We don't know what they called themselves. But that was what they were called by the Picts. That was what they were called by the pagans, those that had rejected Christianity. But somehow, there was something about this community, these servants of God, that was distinctive and different. And I think what was distinctive and different was that they were living out their faith. And what they went on to do was they went on to begin to evangelize the surrounding areas. What did these communities consist of? Well, there were really three things that were right at the heart of them. Let's go to the next slide. First of all, and number one, was worship. You'll know if you know anything about Orthodox Christianity. Worship is very important. There was no evidence of singing in Celtic Christianity. And Anglo-Saxon Christianity did Gregorian chants. In fact, it was Gregory who had sent the first mission over. So they had a very distinctive form of singing. The Celts didn't actually sing because most of the time their worship was done in wee cells all by themselves. There wasn't really much corporate worship in Celtic Christianity. But in the Chaldean form of Christianity, the coming together to worship was at the center. And I remember traveling around eastern Turkey once. And there was a monastery that I wanted to go and stay in. Didn't know if we could get in or not. But we arrived very late at night, and we banged on the door. We were 60 miles from the Iraq border. And the Iraqi war was going on at that time. Still going on, I kind of say, in a way. But we banged on the door, and we said, can we get some shelter? And the guy said, he said, I'll go and get the archdeacon. So the archdeacon came, and the archdeacon came to the door, and he said, we are all children of Abraham, you are welcome. I always loved that phrase, we are all children of Abraham, you are welcome. And we went and we stayed with him. And at 5 in the morning, we had to get up to go, well, we didn't have to, but we wanted to get up and go and join in the liturgy. And much to my surprise in this monastery, because I was just expecting to find a bunch of old men sort of surviving the last few years of their life before Christianity died out. Actually, the monastery was full of dozens, if not hundreds, of young men. And we went into the service, and the young men divided into two groups, roughly of about 40 or 50 on either side, and they began to sing. And the idea was, we are recreating the worship of heaven. And the idea in Orthodox worship is that the worship of heaven is going on all the time. And that when we begin to worship, we just join in the worship of heaven. And then when we stop, the worship of heaven continues. But this worship was at the center. And they began to sing. They began to sing. And I believe that when Saint Serf and his colleagues arrived, they began to establish communities where they worshiped, where they sang. I think the last echoes of that are found on the Western Isles of Scotland. I think that you will hear the way that they were singing, and they began to worship. But the other thing that they did was, they didn't bind their lives together by some rule. In other forms of monasticism, rules were very important. So you basically were given a list, and you had to live all these rules, and that way you became a good monk. But for these individuals, that wasn't the way that they did it. They did it in terms of example. And so what you did was you identified those who had gone before you, who had provided an example of Christianity, and then you sought to live out their example. And through living out their example, you sought perfection. And so you worshipped and you lived out your faith. And then you were open to the Spirit of God and the supernatural. And the story of Christianity in Alva, in Tillicoutry, in Dunning, is the story of miracles, of men like Serf going in and establishing worshiping communities that were following the example and demonstrating the power of God. That's how they converted Scotland. That's how they converted the Picts, rather. But that's how the Picts in Northern Scotland was converted. You see, these three things, and I still think these three things are fundamental to us, to communities that worship, but more importantly than worship, to communities that live out the example of our faith. One of the tragedies of Christianity today is that we just don't really have examples. You know, if I asked a youth group, who are the Christians you look up to? They would probably look like I was insane. You know, who do we look up to? We most Christians, we would suggest, are bad role models. And certainly the ones that jump to mind are usually the bad role models. But who are the people that are living out their faith, who are being the examples? You see, what converted the Picts, who had been resistant to Christianity for several hundred years, was people who came and worshipped and lived out their faith amongst them in a supernatural way. Serf healed people. We have stories of people who were blind being held and healed in places like Alva and Tillicutri. And in fact, he goes on to tell us that the story of Saint Serf, that actually he defeated a dragon in Dunning. You see, St. Serf moved from Cool Ross, and he moved through Alpha, and he moved through Tillicutri, and he moved up through Dollar, and then he crossed through the Dollar Glen to Dunning. And Dunning was the center of Pictish power, the High King, if there was such a thing in Scotland. Probably wasn't. But the principal Pictish ruler was found in Dunning. But more importantly, Dunning was also where the religion of Scotland was principally founded for the Picts. Not a lot of people know, but in Dunning, there is a prehistoric monument, a Stone Age monument, that actually is about four times larger than Stonehenge. Any monument, in fact, in the whole of Western Europe, pales in significance to what is found there. They believe that it was a religious center that maybe drew the whole of Western Europe to it. If you go there, you will see absolutely nothing except a teeny-weeny church now. But actually, and the reason is because everything that was put up there was actually built of wood. It was made up of great oaks, and there were over 250 great oaks that were set out in a sacred precinct with corridors and things. If it was there, we would have the best tourism in the entire world, because it is considered the ultimate prehistoric center. And so there was an ancient center from 5,000 years ago that was used there. They had used it 4,000 years ago for a burial site, and a Bronze Age king was buried there. Let's go to the next slide. And they opened this tomb. They found a tomb. We don't often find tombs, but they found a tomb a couple of years ago there, right in the middle of this sacred precinct from 4,000 years ago. And they opened it. This was them taking the stone off the top of the tomb. And it was so well preserved that the flowers that were placed in the tomb with the body were still there together, meadowsweet. You can go and see them in the Perth Museum on a day out. And at the center of this tomb, amazing tomb that they found. But more interestingly, and for whatever reason, the Picts had continued that community memory of this as a sacred place. And so when Christianity came to the Picts, it was here at Dunning that became the center of the new church that was born for the new nation of Scotland. And St. Serf is portrayed as defeating a dragon. Now, if you ever go to the east, you'll know that you'll see lots of images of dragons being defeated, particularly St. George. Again, I remember when I was touring around Syria, seeing inscriptions relating to the defeat of dragons. And in the East, when you read of the defeat of dragons, you're always reading of the defeat of paganism. Because the killing of the dragon is the killing of paganism. And it was men like George who were saints in the East who defeated paganism and brought Christianity. And so it is with St. Serf. The story of St. Serf and the dragon in Dunning is telling us that it was here that Serf defeated the paganism of the Picts. And it was here that a new church was born, a church that was going to be the foundation for the birth of the nation of Scotland. Actually, at Dunning, let's go to the next one, a king called Constantine. Again, it's funny, we started to call our kings. Everybody stopped calling themselves Angus and Fergus at this point, and they start calling themselves Constantine. It's very interesting, isn't it? No Eastern influence here then. And he established a sacred precinct. And the sacred precinct had four great stone crosses. There's one that survives. If you go to Dunning, you can see it. It's amazing. It's beautiful. Four great stone crosses that were put out at various points. And in the middle of it, they built a great church, a stone church. You can actually see the arch of it in the Scottish Museum, and it is there. And this was at the heart of Scotland, at the heart of the Pictish lands. The Church of Jesus Christ was now established. And it was from this and from this foundation that actually Scotland was born. And it was actually in this that we see the birth of our nation. What was it that brought people to faith? What was it that made Scotland Christian? It was Christians who worshipped, who sang the praises of God, and who were about worship, who came together and acknowledged God as their Lord and Savior, and who then went and said, what kind of example are we setting in terms of our lives? What can we learn from St. Seraph and the Chaldeans? Well, I think we can ask ourselves about the example that we set. Is the example that we set in our lives, is the example that we set in terms of our churches, the kind of example that will convert a nation? Or is it the kind of example that will turn a nation off, that will push people further away from faith? Is it the kind of example that can address the socio-political issues that we're facing today? Is it the kind of example that will make people say, there is truly a prophet amongst the people of God? And their God is truly at work? Is it the kind of example that will draw people to Christ in search of salvation and healing? My question as I read the story of St. Seraph, a refugee from Syria who came and changed the north of Scotland and the Christian witness in that part of the world, my question is, do we still carry that same spirit? Do we still embody that same example of worshipers who live out our faith in a way that can change a nation? Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I thank you for those who have gone before. I thank you for the example of St. Seraph. I thank you for the way that they begin to live out their faith. I thank you that strangers from another land could come and impact this land and could shape our future. I thank you for the ways that you worked through them to bring about transformation to the political landscape of Scotland. Lord, I pray that you would enable us to embody that same example, to embody that same representation of Christ, to live out our faith in vivid ways as worshipers of the true and living God. I ask this in your name. Amen.